You're listening to The Alex Jones Show.
You thought the leaden winter would bring you down forever, but you rode upon a steamer to the violence of the sun.
Broadcasting live from the UN stronghold, Austin, Texas, you're listening to The Alex Jones Show.
And the colors of the sea.
Our inbox is flooded with Americans saying they don't watch the news. They listen to our songs instead. Let's keep it 100 and talk reality. 5,000 years of Persian soul, of poetry and light. You sold nuclear threat to every camera in sight, but our leader said nukes are haram on record clear.
All right, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is The Alex Jones Show. I'm your host, Harrison Smith. You know, I don't just want to say it over and over. It's not even bragging, necessarily, but we do say on the War Room quite often, another appropriate name would be the We Told You Show. Welcome back to the We Told You Show, because we just keep getting proved right about everything over and over. The latest is that young girl in Dundee, Scotland, who was on camera with an axe and a knife. And, you know, to us, it was pretty obvious right away. It was like, okay, why would a 12-year-old girl be brandishing a knife and an axe saying she's protecting her younger sister? We believe her. We think she's the innocent person here and that she's a victim. Of course, she gets arrested and the mainstream media comes out saying, well, you know, this is it's actually typical of Scottish people to be in gangs when they're young. And this, and of course, now it's in court and it's come out that the dude was trying to basically kidnap or groom her and her sister. And she was actually defending herself against a hostile, perverted foreigner. So, okay, we were right about that. But it wasn't very hard to figure out. But then again, none of this is very hard to figure out. And I say this because if there's, yeah, here's the famous viral clip that, again, shocking to me that anybody would, you know, be confused at what was actually going on here. But now it's been revealed in court that we were exactly right and that she was the innocent one, as always. Because it's just, you just go with what's obvious. I mean, all of this is just unbelievably obvious, I would think. But that being said, if you've watched The American Journal and then The War Room, as I've been hosting them for the last 6 years or so, I've constantly made Lebanon a central feature of our Middle East coverage, even though it, before very recently, was hardly ever remarked upon. You're way more likely to hear a lot about Syria, a lot about Iran, a lot about Palestine and Gaza and all these other places. But there was always this sort of unspoken elephant in the room, and it was Hezbollah and it was Lebanon. And once you start seeing things from the perspective of Lebanon, like if you are explained the Middle East situation from somebody who lives in Lebanon, a Lebanese Christian especially, everything makes perfect sense. It all becomes perfectly clear what's going on, especially if you look at the Lebanese Civil War and the conflicts in the early 80s that gave rise to Hezbollah. Like, it all actually starts to make perfect sense, the different factions that arise, who's helping who, how you've got the Israelis on the side of the radical Muslim extremists, where the Shiites and the Christians are teaming up, but the Catholics kind of flip-flop here or there. It gives you really interesting insight. And so I feel like we're constantly being validated, especially because I do a show called Moonbase. My friend Lebanon John, he goes by Lebanon John for a reason, right? His parents are from Lebanon, grew up in America. We were in the same classroom when the planes hit the towers in 9/11. And ever since then, I got a unique perspective from him. Helped red pill me at the tender age of 11. To understand, like, oh, okay, I see who the bad guys are in the Middle East. It's actually not all that complicated. It's not this, like, intractable realm of chaos where just, like, endless feuds continue forever. It's like, no, there's actually very identifiable political motives. The characters, you know, acting in this play are identifiable. Their motives are not, you know, hard to figure out. It's all actually fairly simple. It's just brutal and horrific. So I was asking him about, and the thing that Benjamin Netanyahu about this, said about the spider web. If you were listening to War Room a couple weeks ago when Lebanon John called in, he talked about this spider web thing and said, if you see Israel mentioning spider web, this is what it means. So I don't have the exact story remembered precisely, but essentially Israel captured this area a long time ago. This may have been in the 2000s. And said, you know, Hezbollah fell into our spider web. Then Hezbollah did a counterattack, completely wiped out the Israeli forces, forced them out, defeated them in this war, and responded saying they were as weak as a spider web. We broke them like one would break a spider web. So like this symbolism that they're talking about, this is like stuck in the Israeli mind. It has been like psychologically torturous for them, knowing that their own insult was turned around and they were mocked. Their weakness was, you know, celebrated by Hezbollah. So it's just one of those things that if you're watching War Room, if you're following Lebanon John, it's like you're constantly understanding things in a way that the vast majority of Americans have no idea. They're like, spider web, what the hell is he talking about? This is why this is happening. What's happening in Lebanon is not a reaction to Hezbollah attacks. It's not a continuation of the war in Gaza. It's continuation of an ongoing war that has been waged against Lebanon for the last 40 years or so by Israel. And it's just different flare-ups and low points and high points, but this is like nothing new, and it's not going to end right now. So it's just, it's that type of thing that you go, okay, everything he said in the past has come to fruition. I think I'll listen to him now about what happened in the future. That seems reasonable to me. No, it's just funny because we'll be just right predicting everything, and people can see that and will acknowledge that, and then just be like, but you're totally wrong about what's going to happen next. And it's like, okay, all right, fine. You keep saying that, and we keep being right. But fine, believe whatever you want. So this was the, I asked him for some input into the ceasefire. It's pretty simple. He says, basically, the United States needs time to be ready for round two, which has got to be more crazy. And the only way Iran is going to give them more time to prepare is if they lay off Lebanon for a little bit. But round two is coming, and it's going to be way crazier. And I tend to agree. That is certainly the vibe that I get. Again, with all of the weapons and all of the personnel moving to the Middle East, the closing of Syrian bases to reallocate those resources to a forward position. Yeah, I don't think it's over by a long shot. And it's also been all but confirmed that the supposed pilot rescue a couple weeks ago, last week, whenever it was probably cover for sort of a last-ditch effort to seize the uranium and end the war on a high note that way. But that failed, so now we're backing down, doing a little ceasefire, give us time to prepare, give Israel time to sort of repair itself, because Iran said, look, when this two-week ceasefire is up, we're going right back at it unless we have an agreement. And so America and Israel are trying to forestall that, forestall that as much as humanly possible. Syrian army takes control of last U.S. base in country as al-Shara tightens grip. And then we've got a lot of stuff like this. Senate rejects fourth attempt to curb Trump's war powers in Iran. On Wednesday, the Republican-led Senate voted 52-47 to block a war powers resolution that would have forced withdrawal of U.S. forces from hostilities with Iran absent congressional authorization. So, you know, this is what I mean when you've got, you know, we can blame this on Trump, but Congress and the Senate are totally abdicating their responsibility to actually declare war. That's their prerogative. They have to assert it. They have to be the ones to say, hey, President, you're not allowed to go to war without our approval. They're not doing that. They're happy to let Trump basically wage this alone and take the blame alone. But really, it's their fault that this is happening as much as his, because they have the ability to prevent it and they're choosing not to. The real problem with this, of course, is that the shortages that are being created by the war in Iran are deliberate and being taken advantage of, getting worse and no sign of ending. Europe could run out of jet fuel within weeks, IEA warns. Airlines risk imminent collapse as Trump's war spikes fuel cost. And the UK prepares for food shortages in worst case scenario as Iran war continues. The US could face food shortages, including chicken and pork, by the summer if the Iran war continues in a worst case scenario drawn up by government officials. A government source told the BBC it was planning for a scenario which would involve the continued closure of the Strait of Hormuz and breakdowns in the supply of carbon dioxide. CO2 is used in the slaughter of some animals and in food preservation. A spokesman for the Department of Environment, Food, and Rural Affairs said it would continue to work closely with businesses to tackle the impact of the war. But this is what we've been warning about forever. This was sort of a practice run. I mean, how many times have we heard the people who did COVID to us, who did the lockdowns and everything? I mean, they've said explicitly that it was a test run, that it was a, you know, testing process to determine how the world and Americans in particular would respond to forced lockdowns, you know, limitations in their activity, restrictions to their liberty on the basis of invisible threats that only exist on TV. It was always a test, and this is the fulfillment of that plan, of that test. And how many times during COVID did you hear something along the lines of, I got sick because you're not vaccinated? And how much more dangerous and scary is the idea, I'm starving because you have food? And that's certainly where we're going. And with all of the problems in the UK that already exist, what do you think happens when food starts to get rationed? And do you think the native Brits will be prioritized by their government? I mean, it's their government, it's their civilization, spent thousands of years building up this very robust society that actually can plan for the future and store food in the case of, you know, famine, and, you know, do all of these preparatory things as a consequence of the higher level of civilization they enjoy. Are they going to, you know, be rewarded and experience the positive consequences of that preparation? Or is all of it going to be given to Africans who arrived last week and brought nothing with them and are just there to steal things? What do you think would happen? I mean, right now, if you saw the UK government, who do you think would be prioritized if it came to a limitation of food on that island? I mean, things could get really crazy really fast, and they kind of are. Let's go to clip 24 here. As we mentioned, Australia has been one of the hardest hit by the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. And now, very coincidentally, they've had their biggest fertilizer plant taken down and out of commission for 2 months in this all-important time period. And they're trying to put a good face on it. The Prime Minister here, Albanese, is celebrating the huge shipment of diesel fuel they received. And this is being celebrated and, you know, treated as a temporary fix to the supply problem. Let's watch clip 24 now.
My government has secured an additional 100 million litres of diesel from two shipments, one from Brunei, where I was yesterday, and one from South Korea. This is the first of many expected shipments secured under the government's new strategic reserve powers with the support of Export Finance Australia.
Okay, so there he is celebrating the 100 million litres of diesel secured from Brunei and other places. Here's the problem. Australia uses 92 million gallons or litres of diesel a day. So what he's celebrating there is a little over 1 day of diesel fuel usage in Australia. And yet he's celebrating that as if it's a major achievement. That's a very big issue. Now, again, places like China don't have this issue because they didn't fall for the climate change scam. They actually still harvest and use coal, and they get their urea, the fertilizer, nitrogen-rich fertilizer, from their coal deposits. So they're not, you know, stressing about the lack of fertilizer. Western countries are. And, of course, the Dutch farmer protests over the last couple of years have all been about the limitation of nitrogen in the soil as they deliberately shut down some of the most, you know, productive and bountiful places like the Netherlands, which is the like second biggest food exporter in the world, despite being such a tiny country. And so, of course, they have to be targeted for destruction. Let's go to clip number three here. This is the International Energy Agency chief warning about what's coming down the pipe if fuel for jets doesn't get back online.
Breaking news to bring you now. This is from the IEA chief, the International Energy Agency chief, Fatih Birol, saying that Europe has maybe 6 weeks or so of jet fuel left, warning of possible flight cancellations soon. This is being reported by the AP news agency, saying these comments coming to us from Paris. So Fatih Birol, the International Energy Agency chief, saying that Europe has maybe 6 or so weeks of jet fuel left, warning of possible flight cancellations soon. We've, of course, heard similar warnings from the boss of Europe's biggest airline, Ryanair, in previous weeks as well, talking about potential disruption through the course of the early summer. Well, as we approach mid-April, that would align with about June, according to these warnings from Fatih Birol, the IAEA chief, saying that Europe has 6 weeks or so of jet fuel left, warning of possible flight cancellation soon. I'm sure the markets will be watching very closely the outcome of any potential talks between the US and Iran. Suggestions the two sides sitting down again next week. But for the moment, looking at maritime tracking data right now live, it's showing a pretty bleak scene across the Strait of Hormuz, where so much of the world's fuel and oil passes. Very little activity, certainly no tankers passing through that strait.
So there you go. Again, the shortages are not a, you know, unfortunate side effect of this. In my opinion, it's central to the whole reason that we're attacking Iran in the first place. Now I want to go to a video. It's a little bit longer, but I was going to go through and play some of these clips anyway of J.D. Vance at this TPUSA event that was basically empty. As unfortunate as that is, Erica Kirk was supposed to speak there and canceled, apparently due to credible death threats, even though the Secret Service obviously is going to have the entire place on lockdown. So that's very suspicious. So this guy, I believe this is Eric Moutsos. Clip number 34 here. He asked, did TPUSA die with Charlie? So again, it's a bit of a longer video, but I think he makes some good points. And then he shows the clips of J.D. Vance that I was going to show anyway. So here's a little breakdown of the trouble that the Republican Party is in. Let's watch.
Did Turning Point USA die with Charlie? I think most of us knew it was going to happen. Is it happening sooner than we thought? You see this stadium in Atlanta? It's supposed to hold 8,000 people. So let me ask you, how many people do you think came with headliner J.D. Vance, the guy that's supposed to be the next president of the United States? How many people came Turning Point USA event with J.D. Vance? How many do you think? This is about 8 minutes until they started the event. And this is when J.D. Vance spoke.
It doesn't bother me when he speaks on issues of the day, frankly, even when I disagree with how he's applying particular principles. So the most obvious example is...
So let's hear a few of the questions that were asked to him.
President Trump multiple times called the files a hoax. The acting attorney general said Epstein shouldn't be a part of anything at the DOJ. If there are compromised government officials in those files, how can the public trust that this administration will hold anyone accountable when its own Justice Department is actively blocking the investigation? Given that, can you clearly articulate your stance on whether federal entities should have a formal investigation? Thank you.
Yeah. So first of all, you said the associate attorney general or something. I haven't seen that quote, but here's my view on the Epstein matter. Number one, the guy was clearly a scumbag. Okay. Number two, he clearly had extraordinary connections, both with intelligence services, both inside the United States and outside the United States, and also with a lot of very wealthy and powerful people. Okay. Number three, I have been a firm advocate and will continue to be a firm advocate of where we have something. And you know, like, I'm probably more obsessed with this than most officials, okay? Probably more obsessed with this than most people even in this room, is when you see somebody who says something in an email that suggests, you know, there's one email I read, and it's been a little while ago, but it was talking about, you know, one person sent an email to Jeffrey Epstein saying, oh, there were some really nice, like, pizzas and grape sodas or something like that. And I remember it sounded like the Pizzagate conspiracy theory, but here it was in like an email from a guy. And my reaction to that was, we should absolutely investigate that person, okay? And, you know, you remind me, I'm going to follow up on that to see whether we've investigated that person, because we should. We absolutely should. When you see evidence of sexual assault, sexual misconduct, regardless of whether you're powerful or not, in fact, you should probably investigate it more if you're a powerful person, right? I don't want powerful people, you know, being involved in this disgusting behavior. But I have to defend the president on this, because when he said that it was a hoax, what he was talking about was this Democratic idea that he's connected to Epstein. If you look at those emails, it's like, you know, they were in the same, you know, everybody in Palm Beach knew everybody, okay? Like, the president has said he knew Jeffrey Epstein and he was a scumbag.
Listen what this person yelled out.
I certainly think the answer is yes, and I agree. Jesus Christ certainly does not support genocide, whoever yelled that out from the dark. He certainly does not. I think that's pretty easy. I think that's a pretty easy principle. Okay, so here's a guy. Let me just say this. This is a guy.
Now here's J.D. Vance gaslighting everybody about the wars in the Middle East they promised not to do. It's just one topic that we can just disagree with and move on in full confidence in this administration.
Issues like, for example, I recognize that a lot of young voters don't love the policy that we have in the Middle East. Okay, I understand that. I also know that we've secured the border. We've lowered housing prices now for 8 months in a row, and there's going to be more to come beyond that. We've made America energy dominant, which has lowered electricity costs and things like that. We've made it so that we have the lowest murder rate in 127 years. I'm not saying you have to agree with me on every issue. I'm not saying you have to agree with me on every issue. What I'm saying is, don't get disengaged because you disagree with the administration on one topic.
See, I'll take a stop right here. This is what frustrates me. It's like, I was thinking about this. I was trying to come up with a metaphor. I think this could actually be a successful like sitcom. Because what I'm picturing is like J.D. Vance has been put in charge of a fort. See, there's this fort that the enemy had, and we spent 4 years in brutal trench warfare with very little hope of victory. But after 4 years of just brutal fighting and catastrophic losses, we actually finally took the fort. And we took the fort, and we knew that we had four years to get it prepared for the next assault. We know the Democrats are coming. The enemy forces are coming. We got 4 years to get the fort ready and to refortify it. And so it's like, all right, this year we got to rebuild the walls. We got to dig the moat. So next year we can fill the moat in and we can start putting the armaments on the walls. It's like, we got to get things in place because we got 4 years to get ready or we're all going to die. And so you come back a year later and you're like, all right, How we doing on the preparations? You know, they're coming in 4 years, maybe sooner. So like, where are we at? And they're like, oh, we're doing great. We toilet upstairs flushes now. So we got that going. We're working on getting the rats out of the basement. They are still there, but there are less of them coming in. Okay. We've resawed the lawn. So it looks really nice. And it's like, no, where are the fortifications? Where is the preparation? What are we doing here? Where's all the people? Where's all the soldiers? They're like, oh, we sent them over there to deal with we're doing a favor for our friend, our greatest ally, Israel. We're going and doing some errands for them right now. Do we need those guys? Like, yeah, we need those guys. Why are we doing favor? Who told you? And it's like, that guy over there. And it's Mark Levin, and he's like putting explosives under the wall. And it's like, yes, hi, thank you for that. Thank you for doing that. And it's like, well, that guy's clearly, he's sabotaging us. He's clearly on the side of the bad guys. Why are we doing this? I feel like you could do like an hour show just sort of in a giant metaphor for everything that we're doing wrong. So I don't care about any of that stuff. It doesn't matter. I don't care if the toilet flushes. We're all going to be burned alive. Like, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? Why would we be happy or satisfied with these incremental moderate gains? We're fighting a life and death battle for the future of our nation, and you're not taking it seriously enough. So we're not going to be satisfied with the minor improvements to the fort. We need total war so that we survive the next round of Democrat insanity, and you people are not doing it, and you're telling us to calm down and trust the plan. We're not going to calm down and trust the plan. You do it, or things are going to get insane. What do you not understand about this? Ladies and gentlemen, you know the power of turmeric, but have you felt it? Have you tried the ultimate turmeric gummies, the delicious way to harness the ancient power of golden turmeric, supercharged with ginger root and black pepper for maximum impact? Each gummy delivers 125 milligrams of premium turmeric extract packed with curcumin, the clinically studied compound shown to support healthy inflammation response, ease everyday aches, and promote joint comfort so you can move through life with ease. We added real ginger root, trusted for centuries to calm digestion and soothe the stomach, plus a precise dose of black pepper extract with pepperine, proven to boost curcumin absorption by up to 2,000%. That means more of the good stuff actually gets where your body needs it. No capsules, no bitter aftertaste, just one tasty tropical-flavored gummy a day, or two if you're feeling extra, to help you feel lighter, looser, and more energized. Ultimate Turmeric Gummies, ancient wisdom meets modern science in the best-tasting form possible. Grab yours today and start feeling the ultimate difference in health. With Ultimate Turmeric Gummies, inflammation doesn't stand a chance. Get yours today at thealexjonesstore.com.